It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, a look at President Obama's visit to Waukesha earlier today. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
Our next guest wanted to find out why inmates with mental illnesses don't always take advantage of available mental health services after release from jail.
To help find out, she surveyed participants in a re-entry program and asked them about what types of help they would need after release, and found that in terms of priority, seeking treatment for mental illness was pretty low on the list for them.
Amy Wilson joins us now. She's a professor at Case Western Reserve University, where she studies people with mental illness involved in the criminal justice system. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like it'd be a tough enough transition in any circumstance getting out of jail. For people dealing with mental illness, how much more complex does that make it?
Well, so I think you have to think of it in terms of the number of needs that are confronting them. It is hard for everybody, as you said, leaving jail or prison. But the sheer number of needs confronting people with serious mental illness can kind of boggle the mind. You have to think about that they have incredibly high rates of co-occurring substance use disorders, very high rates of poverty and homelessness prior to their incarceration, and high rates of comorbid medical conditions. So they have a lot of issues, not just their mental illness, that they have to address. And then in addition to that, the intensity or the severity of these different issues confronting them are really quite high. They often have a lot of symptoms related to their mental illness, long entrenched histories of substance use. And many people with serious mental illness live on public assistance programs by policy design, and that's a very low level of money. And so they're constantly eking by, even when public assistance is working for them. And then the last thing you have to think about is that these aren't separate problems. That in the end, they all interact with each other in a way that really confounds our social service delivery system, which is, we call it a silo approach. Mental health services are designed to address the mental health problems, and then you're supposed to travel across town to another agency to deal with their substance use problems and somewhere else to deal with getting your public assistance. So you kind of get the sense there that a lot of effort has to be put out in terms of addressing all these needs.
If I'm understanding your work correctly, we're finding that even in cases where there is that mental health help available, people aren't using it, and you set out to survey why that is. What kind of things topped a priority list for somebody in this situation?
That's a great question. I would add, I did a survey within the context of a year and a half that I spent doing ethnographic observation. So I followed along with the activities, observing, using participant observation in interviews, observing people's experiences. These were returning inmates and their case managers. So what tops our list above anything else is finding a place to live. And this is people with mental illness leaving jail. Over 70%, honestly, I'm one of the first people in the academic literature to ask the clients themselves to generate their list of service needs. Mostly, we've relied on professional judgment in the past for this. And so my goal was to see it from their perspective. And by and far, they said a place to live and money. And money to meet basic needs. Money to get food, to get clothing, and also, right, this feeds the cycle, to get a place to live. So these two things are very connected. Now, there were two questions in the survey you mentioned. The one said just list all the help areas of help that you need. And about 40% of people did say they needed either substance use or mental health treatment. And here's where I think it gets important. This is a distinction that we made. Then we said the second question was, now, if you could only choose two areas, what would be the two most important areas? And this is where you see the people who identify at treatment for their mental health or substance use, only 12% chose it as one of their top two, while housing and money stayed in the top two. 70% chose housing and 40% chose money as one of their top two categories of needs, if forced to choose. When you think about leaving jail, they are in essence forced to choose because they have so many needs confronting them that involve a lot of complex help seeking. They have to make decisions about where to start.
And you're talking about jail in particular here. And coming out of prison, I guess there's a predictable date. I'm out in a year. I'm out in 2 months. Jail is harder to predict, right?
Yeah. So there's a couple differences between jails and prison, and I believe most of it's driven by two things, just the magnitude. Okay, the prisons. I looked this up actually just recently. It's about 650 people entering and leaving prison each year. Well, there's 12 million people entering jails each year and 9 million leaving. So just the magnitude of it creates a crush that limits the ability to do good release planning. And then you've hit the other piece is the unpredictability. Jails have pretrial people, and so people can leave any day, any time. Even the best release planning can fail if people, you know, can leave unpredictably.
So what's at stake? What if people who could really benefit from this mental health assistance don't get it when they get out of jail?
Well, so I think there's a couple things at stake. The one is there's the impact on the individual, okay? Because I hope I've been able to portray these are people with a number of needs, one of which is mental health treatment, and I don't want to obscure that. And the cost of not treating that for the individual can be great in terms of negative outcomes, you know, related to their health, their quality of life, related to their use of expensive community services like emergency rooms and hospitals. And it also, many people believe, is at least one of the drivers of their high rates of recidivism, right? So although there are probably other factors at play there as well. So there's a lot of costs to the individual, to the community through services and the jail for and the correctional system for not being able to deal with this.
You mentioned the silo approach where maybe food assistance is over here, living assistance is over here, mental health here. What would be a better way? Do you have a sense of what would make a better approach where people would get all the assistance they need maybe in one place?
Well, I mean, that's the ideal. And when you talk to people who talk about reentry planning from jails and prisons, and we've seen some movement in that way, this idea of this one-stop shopping. And that certainly, almost any, I think, reentry planner or person building a program is going to tell you, I mean, that's the dream. And what a lot of programs have been able to achieve around the company, to their credit, around the country, is you're creating a place where all these different services come in and try to engage the person. But that's just the point of entry, and it's a great start. But, you know, still, to get all of the services that they learn about in these one-stop shops, they still have to do this, what I call a scavenger hunt, approach to services when they first get out. And that requires, just think what it requires to get all over a city or a town. You have to have transportation or money for it. You have to have basic neat things like weather-appropriate clothing that fits. And these, you know, I observed a number of people being released, and many people lack these things when they leave jail. And I think that's shocking for a lot of us. But, you go into jail and you leave with jail with what you had when you went in, and often the weather, the season has changed. And also people can put on weight in jail just based on the nature of the food that they eat. So, you know, so things change, but their resources don't change. And, you know, so, I always say dealing with the problem holistically. Now that's a challenge, and I know that's a challenge to policymakers, but I think we have to recognize the connection between meeting a person's basic needs and how that facilitates their ability to get into treatment. And although I think intellectually many of us recognize that, we're not seeing that played through in policy.
You mentioned that you surveyed the inmates and people who are out. You did an ethnographic approach. You talked mm-hmm. to them, probably interviewed them. Were they surprised that somebody was asking them what they thought they needed?
Yes, it was deeply humbling. That is that I appreciate that question. Some people were really surprised, and they were very honored that they saw somebody, you know, from a university, right? You know, the professor, they called me sometimes, you know, and where I just tried to blend in and be like them. But, you know, they were very surprised, and some people would dress up for some of the formal interviews, and they took this very seriously. But honestly, you know, as I went along and followed along with it, I was focused on their help-seeking activities, so that's their part of their life I followed along with. You know, there was a lot of frustration in talking to me about, you know, make this matter, you know, help people see that how hard this is.
Do you think there'll be more research like what you're doing? Do you think policymakers will start trying to look toward the kind of thing you're doing as they try to solve these problems?
You know, I certainly hope so. And I should say that there have been a lot of movement towards trying to get people with mental illness leaving jails and prison faster access to Medicaid. And that's a health insurance program. And that's important, and I recognize that. But health insurance helps us provide the mental health treatment. My argument is we also need to be focused on removing these extensive barriers, or somehow dealing with the number of barriers there are to getting cash assistance, because this is a population we want to be able to get on public assistance. This is how we support them in many of these individuals in the community. But it's our country as a relationship with giving out cash assistance has a long history, complicated history. And I know this is very hard for policymakers to address, but it is, we must. If we can't find a way to meet their basic needs, it just goes to reason that if somebody is struggling to find food to eat and a place to sleep, that they can't even think about mental health treatment.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amy Wilson. She's a professor at Case Western Reserve University. She studies people with mental illness involved in the criminal justice system. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out what happens to all that salt that we dump on roads through the winter months.
First, President Obama visited Wisconsin today as part of his post-State of the Union tour. He was at a Waukesha GE plant to promote his job training plans, among other things. Here's a sample of what he had to say.
Because the defining project of our generation, what we have to tackle right now, what has driven me throughout my presidency, and what will drive me until I wave goodbye, is making sure that we're restoring opportunity to every single person in America.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach was on the scene for the president's visit, and he joins us now. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So tell us, what was the main message of President Obama's talk today?
Well, he was looking for a place that he's been touring since the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, and he was looking for another place where employment is up. There's been some job training going on, and I think it's important still to the president that it's a union plant. So he chose the General Electric plant in Waukesha. GE bought the plant from Dresser Industries a few years ago. GE says employment has gone up there from about 275 to about 400. Workers. So all in all, seemed like a good place, I think, for the Democrats and President Obama to say, listen, the economy is getting better. We wanted to do even better, though, with job training and other issues. And this is a good place to present that message.
Now, did he make any new proposals, or was he pretty much talking about things he's been expressing for a while now?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you watch the State of the Union Tuesday night, listen to it on WPR, of course, then maybe there weren't a lot of new things. There were a few new things, though, just sort of added touches. For example, he signed an executive order or memo formally starting the federal review on job training that he announced the other night, job training programs to be led by Vice President Joe Biden. It's a somewhat controversial move in that House Republicans are saying today that the General Accounting Office 2-3 years ago did a review, and wouldn't Vice President Biden's review be duplicate all that? Also, others say that it's President Obama is coming around to the job training issue too late. So a bit controversial, but there it was on job training.
Now, he was in Waukesha today. This is an area that typically votes Republican. Does it mean anything? Is it significant that this is where he visited?
Well, again, I think by talking to blue-collar workers at a union plant, I think the suggestion is that he wants to keep those folks in the Democrats' camp. President Obama not running again, but there is an election or two coming up in Wisconsin this fall, and doesn't hurt to remind folks that the Democrats say they're in favor of supporting job training, full employment, more employment, better jobs, and so on.
Now, he was, as we said, speaking at a GE plant in Waukesha, and we have a clip that you recorded from a GE executive. Here it is.
Anybody that's helping me grow this business, supply skilled trades, I don't care what politician it is, you know, I'll work with anybody. It's a big issue. I can't grow my business without skilled trades.
Okay, a quote there from a GE executive. In general, how did President Obama's speech and visit play there?
Well, that was GE executive Brian White, who basically runs the plant or is in charge of the plant overall. He was being asked corporate executives don't often have nice things to say about this president, but Mr. White did, because he liked what he was saying about job training, that's needed to get highly technical skilled workers ready to go at GE, and that he was also, Mr. White was also saying he liked other things in the president's speech, which recapped a few things that were said Tuesday night.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the plant where President Obama visited? How does it fit into what the president had to say?
Well, again, it's a plant that's seen growing employment, produces gas-fired engines that are being exported around the world, also, you know, being sold to U.S. Customers as well. It's just seemed that the plant is relatively trouble-free. Now, I don't know if the plant employment is as big as it was 10 or 15 years ago. There's a lot of manufacturing plants that say the same thing, but it's an example of where jobs, manufacturing jobs, are starting to tick up a bit.
Now, we heard in the news earlier that there were protesters at that event. Can you tell us anything about who these people were and what their issues with the president were?
Well, there seemed to be two main camps, and again, these were not large protests, but Americans for Prosperity, a conservative-funded group, a pro-business group, was there suggesting the president was late on the issue of job training and that the president's economic policies fail in comparison to what Governor Walker has been doing for the state. The other main protests seemed to be sort of the far other end of the spectrum. Voces de la Frontera, a Latino group based in Milwaukee, was there. They've been quite upset with the continued deportations of non-residents, even as President Obama says, let's get immigration reform done, that deportations folks have continued, and Voces is concerned about that. So the president sort of got it a little bit from both sides, and it also snowed on him as he was driving, you know, as the motorcade was driving from the plant back to the Milwaukee airport.
Now, as you said, this is his post-State of the Union tour, and we've also heard that the president's approval ratings have been dipping. Can you just give us a sense of what his demeanor was like? How did he seem? Did he seem like a president who was struggling, or did he seem like, you know, he was still owning his power?
Well, you know, I don't know if it quite had the energy of some of his campaign rallies of 2012. Those were all very upbeat and so on. He was talking a little more sedate topics today, like job training and the Affordable Care Act. He did mention that. He also talked about minimum wages, raising the minimum wage, hoping Wisconsin would go along with an effort to raise the minimum wage, and also talked about equal pay for women. So very serious topics. He did add some elements of humor, suggesting that when his wife is happy about things, and he was getting into the minimum wage issue with this, and trying to convince men in the audience that raising the minimum wage for all is a good thing. Mr. Obama was saying basically when his wife is happy, he's happy.
Well, Mary Burke, who's running for the Democratic nomination for governor, she was not planning to be at the event. Apparently, she was campaigning in the western part of the state, and there has been some to-do over why she wasn't there and whether or not that's significant. What is your take on that, and what do you know about her not meeting with the president?
Well, her campaign says she talked with the president by phone yesterday. The suggestion from critics has been that Ms. Burke does not want to appear in the same photographs or the same TV footage as the president, with his approval rating now down to 44%, according to a Marquette University poll released earlier this week. Others say, well, you know, she's not the official Democratic candidate yet for governor, that the president is likely to be back once Ms. Burke or whoever is chosen in the August primary, and that this was just a temporary parting of the two, not wanting to be in the same, not being in the same place.
Governor Scott Walker did, however, he met the president on his arrival. Is that a formality, and do you know anything about how that meeting went?
It appeared to be brief from what I saw television footage of. I don't know exactly how it went, but Governor Walker also gave the president a Packers jersey a few years ago when the president came here. So it's not unheard of for Governor Walker to spend a little time with the president, but they did part ways. The motorcade with the president and Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett headed to Waukesha, while Governor Walker apparently went to other business in Madison.
Well, between congressional elections and the race for governor, do you think Wisconsin is probably going to get a lot of attention from national Democrats and Republicans this year?
Well, it will get some, certainly with Governor Walker's prominence nationally. And Peter Barker, the state assembly minority leader, was asked if, you know, if the president would be welcome back during all this, would he be a hindrance to the Democrats' efforts to take the state house and take the governor's chair? Barker insisted that President Obama's dip in the ratings is temporary, that things will perk up, and that the president will be welcome back here. So if that's right, we will see the president back and the accompanying national media to go with it.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Cormack. He covered the president's visit to Waukesha earlier today.
We're going to stay with this topic after the news, and we want to hear from you. What do you think the president should be addressing when it comes to Wisconsin, when it comes to the economy? What do you think of what he said this week about economic issues? Do you support the idea of boosting the minimum wage, signing regional trade agreements, boosting alternative energy while continuing natural gas production? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll take your calls after a look at the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. President Obama was in Waukesha today to talk about job creation and job training. And now we're looking for your advice for the president. What would you like to see from the president when it comes to boosting the American economy? Call in now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're taking your calls right now. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
In his State of the Union address, and again today in Waukesha, the president called for an increase in the minimum wage. He wants more investment in clean energy while still promoting domestic natural gas production. He wants more free trade agreements, including a big one with Europe, another one in the Pacific. And as he said in Waukesha, he's looking for more job training to match people's skills to the jobs available. Agree or disagree? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Ken in Verona to start things off with us. Ken, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi there. My opinion on this minimum wage has evolved over time, not to steal something from the president, but at first I thought by raising the minimum wage several dollars an hour that I just started sliding down the hill here.
Uh-oh.
I'm okay now. That it would put an upward pressure on inflation. Mm-hmm. And then I heard an individual from, I believe it was California, conservative, who used to be an editor of some conservative magazine. I don't remember the name now. But he commented that by raising the minimum wage, and out there they wanted to go to $12 an hour, which would be approximately equivalent to $9 here, because he said that there would be less pressure on social services, less food stamps, less need for taxpayers to take care of the poor, basically, because people would have their own money and they could support themselves. They might need some help, but they would be a lot less pressure on social services, on taxpayers. So I thought, you know, that's a good way of looking at it. And he also felt as though it would only increase retail prices by maybe 1%.
Ken, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts on the minimum wage increase.
Appreciate that call. We go next to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. As I was on hold, I listened to the previous caller who almost said the same thing I'm going to say, that I think that it should be an increase in minimum wage for everybody, full-time, part-time, no exceptions. Don't play games with it. And then you'll see a subsequent reduction in government expenditures for the poor. And I think that that's – and I'm a conservative, too. And so I think it's a good way for the conservatives and the liberals to come together and get something done in Washington.
All right. So Ralph's saying you want the president to go farther than he's saying he's going to go so far.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate that.
We'll go now to Ashley. She joins us from Green Bay. Hi there, Ashley.
Hi, guys. I've listened for a long time. First time I've called in, and it seems like the appropriate time because my comment on this issue is, although I think that raising the minimum wage is an excellent idea in general because I feel like the state of Wisconsin, could definitely use that, I was wondering what the president, or he hasn't made any strides in the area of raising the minimum server wage. And on my personal research, I've realized that it hasn't gone up in the state of Wisconsin since like the mid 70s. And they're still making $2.33 an hour. I actually work for Costco. So I'm, like I said, in the pre-screening, like I'm very thankful for having a well-paying job, but you know, some of my friends that are servers, which usually you can make quite a bit of money, they're barely making it by and getting checks for $0 and 0 cents. And nobody really seems to be aware or wanting to change that subject. So I guess my question is do you think that the minimum wage is going to raise from servers as well as everybody else? Like, are we going to get on that bandwagon? Because the state could really use the increased wages in that area, you know?
Thanks a lot for the call, Ashley. I have not heard if, I know Democrats in Wisconsin have a minimum wage proposal, probably won't pass the Republican legislature. I don't know if it has a separate line in it for tipped employees, for mainly servers. So that's an interesting thing to check out in the future.
And thanks for that first call, Ashley. It's good to hear from you. And on to Dave in Menasha. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I'd like to see federal projects use 100% U.S.-made materials. I've worked on a lot of them. I'm in the construction business, and I see that, you have all these foreign things. We're spending all this government money and putting people to work in foreign countries. And, if you get on military projects, it's in the millions of dollars that are going away that our people never get a chance to spend. Our economy doesn't get a chance to circulate. And I think that would bring up, at least it put a lot of people to work here in Wisconsin and other states.
And, Dave, did you watch the State of the Union address?
I did not get a chance to at all.
That was something President Obama talked about, incentivizing businesses to bring work back here to America. So if that's on his agenda, sounds like you're behind that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks much for the call, Dave. Appreciate it.
A couple lines have opened up now. We're looking for your thoughts, your advice for President Obama on how to deal with economic issues, your reactions to what he has said in the State of the Union this week here in Wisconsin when he was in Waukesha today about the need. He's calling for more job training, an increase in the minimum wage, more investment in clean energy while still keeping a lot of focus on natural gas, more free trade agreements. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I really think that this discussion of minimum wage is missing the important point that we need to invest in education. Minimum wage is for 14, 15, 16-year-olds who are getting into the workforce for the first time. The working poor need education so they can make a better wage. If we keep raising the minimum wage, the people who are just arriving in the workforce aren't going to be able to get any jobs at all. And I think it's a shadow game. It really worries me.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Sam. We'll go now to Donna in Green Bay. Hi, Donna.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hi.
Donna, could you turn your radio down? We're hearing me in the background there.
Okay. It's Isabart.
So what did you want to bring up about the economy and the president?
I would like to see the wages increased for waitresses and waiters, people in the food business. The restaurants make their money. Why shouldn't they be paying minimum wage for their employees? They work hard for their tips, but they need to pay taxes on those. So I think it should be clear across the board.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Donna.
And we go next to Mark. Mark joins us from Mineral Point. Hey, Mark. Mark, are you there? And not hearing Mark. So let's see. Do we have another call ready to go? Well, let's see. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go to Gary joining us from Lake Mills. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I was just going to mention that a couple economists from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago just did a big study of the minimum wage. They published it in the last couple of months. And it was all about all the positive effects that would accrue to the economy if the minimum wage were increased. Now, I can't remember the exact percent increase in GDP that they predicted, but it was a very positive piece on the positive effects of increasing the minimum wage, and that there were very few negative.
So, Gary, do you see this as the minimum wage as one of the key issues that you'd like to see President Obama address as he goes forward?
I think it'd have a big effect on the economy.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your call.
All right, we'll go now to David in Hurley. David, hi.
Hi. I heard a couple of callers call in about wait staff, waiters and waitresses making $2.33 an hour. And that's true. I've worked many years in restaurants, and I know that with tips, they're supposed to be claimed. And I know restaurants are supposed to make up the difference. So all waiters and waitresses should be making at least minimum wage. So if they leave a shift with no tips, the restaurant has to make up the rest to bring them up to at least minimum wage. And I think if a lot of these people that are calling in, if they're not making at least that, they need to take that up with the restaurant or file a complaint for sure. Because that's the restaurant's responsibility to at least get them to minimum wage. So they're on the same pay scale as everybody else.
All right. Thanks a lot for clarifying that, Dave.
All right. Let's go next to Lynn. This will probably be our last call. Lynn, hi. You're in Spooner, I see. How are you doing?
Good.
What do you think?
I wanted to make the point about how I believe raising the middle or raising the minimum wage actually hurts the middle class. Because what happens is I agree with the caller on the education piece. Minimum wage, because what happens is, you know, the people who work at these stores and things like that that pay minimum wage, the employer is not going to take that cost. I mean, they're going to raise their prices. So the people who are get more minimum wage haven't gained anything. I mean, we're just going to pay more for our products. And so the middle wage, who didn't get a raise increase, is making $19, $20 an hour. All of a sudden, they're paying more for everything and now have more costs. That's what I feel about the minimum wage. I mean, the prices of everything is just going to go up to pay those employees.
All right. Great, Lynn. Thanks so much for calling up and telling us your thoughts. And thank you for your calls. Appreciate everyone who called in. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR.
Seems like the minimum wage issue struck a nerve with people. That's got a lot of people interested. We'll see what you have to say on our Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Next hour, Wisconsin Senators Baldwin and Johnson are the most polarized Wisconsin senators from any single state in the country. They vote against each other 75% of the time. We'll hear how that division plays out in Washington.
First, though, much of Wisconsin is being hit with snow today, with central Wisconsin under a wintry weather advisory for most of the day.
It seems as though the snow and cold weather isn't going to stop this winter. The Midwest and eastern U.S. have been hit several times, and this week, even southern cities from Georgia to Texas are digging out from a freak storm.
As the snow falls, road crews pile on more salt to keep ice off the roads. Many cities are trying to move away from using so much salt, but we still use a lot.
And here to talk about where all that salt goes is Smithsonian Magazine reporter Joseph Stromberg. Joseph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on again, Veronica.
So how much salt is it that we use each year?
It's really an amazingly high amount of salt. And it's estimated that we use 22 million tons annually, which works out to about 137 pounds per person in the U.S. So another way of putting that is that if you put every human on the U.S. on a scale and all the salt on the other end of the scale, it would be pretty close to balancing.
Wow. Well, salt has been our go-to melting device for years now. Why do we use so much of it?
Well, it's pretty effective. It lowers the melting point of water, the freezing point of water. So if we put it down before a storm and after a storm, it breaks up the ice that forms. It lets us drive, go to work, go to school. So it's pretty important, and it's the easiest way we have of doing that right now.
So let's say you've got a snowstorm. Generally, I think what happens is that the plows come out, they clear the snow, and then they go through and salt. If the temperatures are high enough, what happens then? What happens to the salt?
So, it helps melt the ice. Afterwards, though, it gets run off. Surface water takes it past the margins of the roads into local bodies of water, into the groundwater. And specifically, the ions, the sodium chloride ions that make up salt, split. And the sodium doesn't do a ton of damage, but the chloride spreads pretty easily into different bodies of water, even into ground wells. Some people might even end up tasting it in their drinking water. And it has a pretty significant effect on humans, on the wildlife, and on the environment.
So let's look at the human risk right now. You said some people can taste it in the water.
Yeah.
What does that do to people?
Well, I mean, in terms of the overall effects of salt, road salt, this is probably the least problematic, but water utilities do report that they get a spike of complaints about salty tasting water during the winter, and that's because of road salt. A recent USGS study found that about 2% of wells nationwide, so people who, you know, get their drinking water from a well, have levels of chloride that exceed the safe levels established by the EPA. And this isn't a huge health issue for most people, but if someone's on a very restricted low-sodium diet and they're getting in taking in salt through their drinking water, that could be a problem.
So the salt that's on the roads, you're saying, gets into the drinking water. What does that mean about the quality of the water itself?
Well, it only gets into water that's coming from ground wells, so not surface reservoirs and not treated water like that. But people who live in more rural areas and are getting their drinking water from their own wells, that because it's in the groundwater, that's how they would end up getting it.
So you said the effect on humans is probably the least of our worries about salt. What happens to the salt when it goes into the natural environment around?
Yeah, that's more of a problem because obviously a lot of wildlife, a lot of types of animals live in that water directly. And so different streams and bodies of water will end up taking in levels of chloride that are problematic for different forms of life. Scientists have found that organisms like salamanders and frogs and small crustaceans, because they actually take in water through their skin, the levels of salt in the water are going to interfere with the uptake of water into their bodies. And so essentially what's happening is they're getting dried out, and survival rates for those kinds of animals living in artificially elevated environments with too much salt are lower. An overall survey found that about 40% of urban streams in America, so that's streams in areas developed by humans, streams that have more road salt getting into them, about 40% of those have excessive levels of chloride that could be a problem for wildlife.
Have we already seen declining numbers in frogs and salamanders and animals like that who might already be affected?
It's really hard to say. These are also areas where human development is happening in general, and we're paving over different natural environments. We're building roads. We're building houses. So we haven't been able to go and look at this point and say, oh, this many frogs or salamanders died because of road salt. But in controlled experiments, they do see that frogs and salamanders exposed to higher levels of salt in the water because of road salt tend to have lower survival rates.
What about things like fish and aquatic plants? Are they affected?
Yeah, they're affected, definitely. Plants, not just aquatic plants, but you might even see plants, you know, by the side of a road that's heavily salted are turning brown by the end of the winter. That's because all the salt, just like for the animals, makes it harder for them to take in water. And so they're pretty much getting dried out. And so that's most obvious when you have plants right by the side of the road, but it can happen anywhere where you have water getting runoff from the road, carrying salt into any kind of natural environment.
So you talked earlier about just how much salt we use every year, and it's a pretty big amount of salt. Are we overusing it? Do we need to use as much salt as we use?
I think it's really hard to say if we're overusing it. In recent years, there have been a lot of different strategies to actually cut down on the amount of salt we use, such as salting before a storm, which prevents some of the ice from forming, and also mixing in sand and gravel, as most municipalities now do. So you have salt only a percentage of the mix you're putting down, and the sand and gravel also just help tires get traction on the road. So I think, you know, maintenance crews are doing their best to get the roads clear without overusing salt. No one would be happy if they stopped using it entirely and we couldn't, you know, use our cars in the day after a storm or anything like that. So it's hard to say that they're overusing it, but it's important to point out some of the problems involved.
So you're saying it's more effective to salt beforehand? Is it? But would you not then, would you have to use more salt because you're salting twice before and after?
So you would do it both, but overall the amount they found is lower. Because instead of just trying to, if you imagine a thick sheet of ice forming during a storm, if you're just putting salt on top afterwards, it has to eat all the way down through it. Versus if you're preparing the road with salt and gravel beforehand, the ice won't form as thick. So overall, it still cuts down on the amount, even though you're doing it twice.
Where does all the salt come from?
It's an interesting question. It's mostly coming from underground mines. Some of these are in the U.S., but a lot are internationally imported, sometimes from as far as Chile, which is one of the world's biggest salt producers. So it's really an international commodity chain and brought in huge quantities to the U.S.
As far as big problems that environmentalists are tracking, just how big is the problem of salt in the ecosystem?
I think reasonably it's smaller than a lot of other problems. You know, when you look at the recent news about water contamination in West Virginia or global climate change, these huge scale problems that impact humans as well as wildlife and the environment, those are definitely more problematic. But at the same time, salt does have effects on the natural ecosystem, and it's just kind of a further impact of growing development in the U.S. You know, the more development we build, the more roads and houses, the more area we're subjecting to this salt.
Now, you mentioned earlier the effects that salt can have on animals like frogs and salamanders. And in recent years, we've been hearing a lot about deformed frogs, frogs that have been born without legs and that kind of thing. Does salt have anything to do with that, or is it a completely different problem?
I don't know that for sure, but I would guess that it's a completely different problem. Salt is, and especially chloride, is something that's already out there in the environment at lower levels. And so it wouldn't really be likely to cause mutations or anything like that. It's simply that we're elevating the levels and making it harder for animals to regulate how much water they're taking in.
Now, there are lots of different alternatives to salt that are starting to be floated here in Wisconsin. We've started using cheese brine. Can you talk about that and some of the other alternatives that are out there?
Yeah, well, elsewhere I've read about beet juice and sugarcane molasses getting mixed in with the salt. And obviously in Wisconsin, cheese brine is a newsworthy addition to the salt mix. In both Polk County and Milwaukee, maintenance crews have started mixing it in, and they've found that it speeds melting as compared to pure salt. They think partly because the fact that there's some moisture in there helps the salt stick to the road instead of just bouncing off it when they drop it. And by their measures, they're using 30 to 40% less salt when they mix in the cheese brine.
Wow. That's interesting. The problem is that it stinks.
Yeah, that's what I haven't visited Wisconsin since they've started using this. I've heard that. But, you know, yeah, I guess that's a problem that people might have to deal with.
That's interesting. So you said beet juice and molasses are something else that the people are working. If we start turning to those, does that create any other problems that we haven't foreseen yet?
I think at this point, those are both kind of like cheese brine, just used in small trials in certain areas. And they're kind of just testing out to see how it works. I haven't been made aware of any large problems with that, either of those. But it's important to note that both of those, like cheese brine, would just be ways of reducing the salt that's getting used, not eliminating it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll be watching it as we drive over those salty roads here in Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot for having me on. Get home safe.
All right. That was Joseph Stromberg, reporter at the Smithsonian Magazine.